was it Daedalus said, history is a nightmare we're trying to wake up from. And I got to talk a little louder here if I want to communicate. Cheers.
Thank you.
That's always a good line, I guess, even for people that are teetotalers, because we salute you. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, of course, not necessarily shared. I had a myriad of things that I wanted to play as usual, and I settled on a few things. Maybe I need a committee to help me decide or something. The number down here is 359-9338. Don't have anybody on hand, so if stuff's playing that you're interested in and you don't want to take the time out to make a pledge donation over the phone, just go to weft.org and donate there. I always like to mention payroll deduction. When I was fully employed, sort of, I took advantage of that at the U of I. Many, many groups. If you're working for a corporation, there's still that matching. That'd be a great way to get some money out of this corporate, historic corporate profits. I would commend your attention to Radio Free Labor today. They're going to be talking about the successful campaign in New York and the possibility still that the Bessemer, Alabama, it's not likely, but it's much closer than people expected, and there are a lot of disputed ballots, speaking of ballots. Sonali will hear from him, but not that segment. I wanted to get you... mention one of the things I wanted to play that I'm not going to get to, and that's how wages remain shockingly low. Oxfam America, who you think of as intervening around the world against famine, has a U.S. office, and they have a report out with an interactive map of low wages, the crisis of low wages in the U.S. I'm hearing all of these glowing statements about the economy is doing so well, and the Fed consequently has to put the brakes on, and there's still 50 million people making less than $15 an hour. And how they're surviving, I do not know. You have to be, you almost have to have a scam, it seems like. Reminds me of the Friday Forum from last talk, a very transgressive talk from African-American woman Cecily Bowen. The last two Friday Forums, while I'm on the subject, are about local issues. A local pair from the NAACP spoke yesterday, Minnie Pearson and Tom Davis. Next week, a panel of three who are going to talk about Unit 4. They won't be talking about the strike because there was some kind of settlement. Maybe we'll hear a little bit about that. But like I said, we got to spend this COVID relief money because there are so many needs. And also, we need to get to the next tranche of preparation for possible variants. Maybe they'll go to another Greek letter. I don't know what's after Omicron, but it's not impossible. And I pointed out that, and it's been mentioned by the New York Times health writer, Mara Villa is her curious last name. I think she's from Sri Lanka origin or something, maybe. The high HIV immunosuppressant populations we have in various places in the world, notably all over the southern cone of Africa, allows for an incubation of viruses. I don't want to go into this hot zone kind of discourse, but it's there. And I see in a curious way that Big Pharma's avarice has made it even worse because of the underfunding of HIV. I'll make this point, I haven't made it in a while, that one of the few things that the war criminal Bush 2, gets lauded for, even by Africans, is the PEPFAR, President's Emergency Fund for AIDS Relief. But several months before that was enacted, Chaney as the hatchet man, which he's good at. Good with a shotgun, too, apparently. Axed a deal that was going to allow for that AIDS drugs to go into Africa to be generic. So Big Pharma wouldn't get the... Well, they got it, and that decreased the amount that was effectively spent on AIDS, the response to AIDS, which gives us this reservoir of HIV-positive and immunosuppressed people. It's not that complicated of arguments. I guess it's got some moving parts. But already 5 minutes in, and I have a total hour of stuff to play here. I'm not going to play anything about Yemen. Apparently there's a ceasefire for 2 months, longer than Ramadan. But I believe it when I see it. I don't believe anything from Mr. Maestro Bonesaw, MBS, in Saudi Arabia. And it's Boris Johnson made his pilgrimage. Maybe Biden will go too. I hope not. Pressure should be put on him to not go to replacement oil. More pumping from Saudi. All right. Let's see. Amy Goodman's commentary. Oh, yeah. It's on the final passage of a anti-lynching bill. Probably most filibusters used in the 300 attempts, 200 attempts. I don't know. Multiple hundred attempts to pass something like this. Though, I guess... since we're in the history, new history of pocket filibusters, you don't even have to get up and talk, that maybe the record has been broken. I don't know. So Nomu Mia Jamal, I'm about to communicate with the producer there and find out what's going on, whether he's writing a new book or working on his court case. He's got an appeal, but he hasn't put a commentary up in quite a while. It's difficult times for everyone.
The long overdue Emmett Till anti-lynching law. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Biden signed the Emmett Till Anti-Lynching Act into law Tuesday, culminating efforts to make lynching a federal crime that started over a century ago. Michelle Duster, the great-granddaughter of Ida B. Wells, the legendary anti-lynching activist and pioneering African-American journalist, said at the signing ceremony,
"Since my great-grandmother's visit to the White House 124 years ago, there have been over 200 attempts to get legislation enacted. And 17 years ago, in 2005, my brother Dan spoke at the Senate press conference where they issued an apology for not passing the legislation. But we finally stand here today, generations later, to witness this historic moment."
Emmett Till should be alive today. Born on July 25, 1941, he would be 80 years old. Perhaps he would still be joking the way he did throughout his childhood. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, wrote of Emmett, "For Emmett, life was laughter, and laughter was life-giving. There was so much joy in his carefree world that he just wanted to share with everyone around him," she said. Emmett Till, an African-American boy, was brutally murdered August 28, 1955, at the age of 14. He'd been accused of wolf-whistling at Carolyn Bryant, a white woman, then dragged out of his great-uncle's home in Money, Mississippi, where his mother had sent him from Chicago for the summer. Several days later, his brutally beaten, disfigured body, weighted down with a 75-pound cotton gin fan tied to his body with barbed wire, was pulled out of the Tallahatchie River. The LaFleur County Sheriff attempted to force the immediate burial of Emmett Till, but Mamie intervened and paid almost a year's salary for his body to be shipped back to Chicago. There, the funeral director refused to open the box for her to view her son's corpse. Give me a hammer, she demanded. He relented and allowed Mamie to view Emmett's mutilated remains. By then, the murder had sparked outrage across the nation. Mamie Till Mobley insisted that Emmett receive an open casket funeral. Let the world see what I've seen, she said. 100,000 mourners lined up to pay respects. Jet magazine put a picture of Emmett in his casket, his head distended and deformed by violence, on the magazine's cover. The image went global and forced the people of the United States to witness the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry. Two suspects, Roy Bryant, the husband of the woman who claimed she'd been whistled at, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam, were arrested for the kidnapping and murder of Emmett Till. Two brave activists from the Mississippi NAACP, Medgar Evers and Amzi Moore, had been involved since Till was reported missing, first looking for the lost boy, then seeking eyewitnesses to the murder. Despite the eyewitnesses they produced, an all-white, all-male jury acquitted the suspects. One member of the jury said they'd reached their decision within minutes, but waited an hour to appear as if they'd actually deliberated. Medgar Evers himself was later assassinated in the driveway of his home on June 12, 1963. After the acquittal, Bryant and Milam sold their story to Look magazine for $4,000, about the same amount that Mamie Till Mobley had paid to ship her son home, an equivalent to over $40,000 in 2022. Despite their confession to the magazine that they murdered Emmett, they couldn't be prosecuted due to constitutional double jeopardy protections. Had a federal anti-lynching law existed at the time, they could have been charged. Emmett Till's murder galvanized the civil rights movement. Months later, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on the bus in Montgomery, Alabama. When asked why she refused to go to the rear of the bus, she said, "I thought of Emmett Till, and I just couldn't go back." A. Philip Randolph, the renowned African-American labor organizer and civil rights activist, chose the 8th anniversary of Emmett Till's death, August 28, 1963, for the March on Washington, where Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his famous I Have a Dream speech. In 2004, the FBI reopened the Emmett Till case and conducted interviews with surviving eyewitnesses, leading to the identification of several other still-living suspects. In 2017, historian Timothy Tyson published a book on the case, which included a 2007 interview he conducted with Carolyn Bryant. In it, Tyson reports she recanted part of her 1955 court testimony that Till touched her and made lewd comments, a revelation that could have led to her being charged with lying to the FBI. She denied Tyson's account. In December 2021, the Department of Justice formally closed the Emmett Till case. Ida B. Wells wrote, "The way to right wrongs is to turn the light of truth upon them," unquote. While Emmett Till's murderers escaped justice, his short life and his mother Mamie Till Mobley's tireless activism charted the path forward for us all to permanently reject racist terror. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Ida B. Wells did a thing at the turn of this century, was it? For the Chicago exhibition, and even had a chapter written by Frederick Douglass, I'm sorry. Not that other Illinoisan who should be somewhat forgotten. I guess the statue was removed. Put in a more appropriate spot, perhaps. But interesting. And the title was something, I think, comparable to "What does 4th of July mean to the slave? What does the Columbian exhibition mean to Black American?" It's a pretty amazing piece. Her husband, a lawyer, has a couple of chapters, too. It's been a while since I looked at it, but since Ida B. Wells was honored as well there. All right, time is slipping into the future. It's talking about money and relief funding, and it's just astonishing to me that we're getting rescue money to put people in jail. So priorities project at the Institute for Policy Studies, one of the segments will play. We'll play part of Chris Hedges from yesterday. I feel bad about excerpting it, but it was aired yesterday. So, but since I mentioned that IPS program, Bill Hartung, who's a guest at Democracy Now from time to time, was always as eloquent. And there's a segment that he did with another show from Pacifico called Upfront that I've got in the collection today. 359-9338, got a 17-minute segment where I'll be having some breakfast. So don't feel bad about interrupting that. I would take a pledge. I don't see any forms, but I can jot it down and get your specifics. Prefer if you would go online, if that's possible for you, to do it online. Thanks for supporting in any way you can, even talking it up. Access Radio. And we still have the Airshifter training up to Tuesday, April 5th. I guess it hasn't closed yet since it's up. Update your member to qualify. If you're already a member, you can get the basics of community radio policies. It's a live Zoom session, too, so you can do it. There are two sessions after that if you want to follow it further, but maybe that's something you can do. And well, it's up twice. Here's Sonali Kalatar. Her inspiring theme. And
this is Rising Up with Sonali. And
there
I'm
it is.
Host Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. President Joe Biden has announced a $5.8 trillion federal budget, whose key priorities are out of line with his campaign promises. His budget includes significant increases to military and police spending. In an attempt to center the progressive aspects of his budget, Biden announced in a statement that he was taking steps to overturn his predecessor's tax cuts on the rich. But there was no significant spending on social issues, economic justice, or combating climate change. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who heads the Senate Budget Committee, said firmly, quote, "We do not need a massive increase in the defense budget." We turn now to Lindsay Kershkarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the program, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So first, what do you make on the surface of Biden's budget? How does it, say, compare to previous Republican presidents and even Democratic presidents? Is this a fairly, you know, standard, typical budget of the kind that we expect presidents to take, and not like what, you know, we might have expected from presidential candidate Joe Biden?
Yes, Sonali. So for the most part, this is the type of budget release that we would have seen in the past from presidents of both parties. It has an increasing military budget, which you mentioned. The military request in this budget is for $813 billion, which is higher than at the height of the Vietnam War. It's higher than the height of the Cold War. It is higher than the last Trump budget. It is higher than the last Obama budget. So it's trending in the wrong direction. And the other thing we look at is the balance of military to non-military spending in the annual budget. And that too is similar to what we've seen in the past. This budget puts 52% of what's called discretionary spending, the annual spending that Congress passes in their budget, it puts 52% of that into the military. And that means that everything else has to fit into the rest of the pie. And in fact, if you look at the military, Homeland Security, veterans, and things associated with the military, it's actually 2 out of 3 discretionary dollars that are going to those things, leaving only 1 in 3 dollars for everything else.
So the military and sort of broadly speaking, law enforcement, federal immigration enforcement seems to be his priority. It was interesting. I was looking at the New York Times analysis of this budget, and the Times, you know, explained it as this 10% rise that Biden is putting forward comes amid threats like Russia's invasion of Ukraine and concerns about China's ambition. I don't know if this is the New York Times trying to justify what Biden is doing, or this is some reflection of Biden's reasoning itself. But we're technically not directly involved in the Ukraine war, although, of course, we're members of NATO. And it seems clear so far that the U.S. is not actually going to get into any kind of direct confrontation with Russia. Are these justifications really sensible?
No, they're not. These justifications do come from the administration. They come from the Department of Defense and the highest military leaders. And this is something we've been hearing for years, is that we need higher military budgets to address the threats from China and Russia. But if we've learned anything from the Ukraine crisis, it's that decades and years of outspending every other country. We spend as much as the next 11 countries. We spend 12 times as much on our military as Russia does. If more military spending were the answer, we wouldn't be in a situation that we're in now. And more military spending is not the answer to the situation we're in now. And as you suggested, there is a very small part of this budget that is actually directly about Ukraine. The budget that Congress just passed, less than 1% of the military spending in that was for Ukraine. And the Biden proposal doesn't actually call for specific funding for Ukraine. It just calls for general military funding. Now, people will say that that's because we need to be ready to defend NATO, but we've already been spending tens of billions of dollars. For years and years, we've had tens of thousands of troops stationed all over Europe at dozens of military installations. So this ramp up really isn't commensurate with what's happening right now. And most important, if the threat that we had in place before the Russian invasion of Ukraine wasn't enough to deter them, nothing that we're going to add at this point is going to be enough either.
So let's take a step back and look at where the budget is. You mentioned that there's been a budget that's been passed in the House. Where are we? That then, of course, the president puts out their budget blueprint. Ultimately, the Senate and the House get to decide what passes, and then the president can choose whether to sign it or not. So where are we in that process?
So we're in a very strange place in that process, actually. The way it's supposed to work is that the president is supposed to release their budget request in February for the coming fiscal year, which begins in October. So we're a little behind schedule on that, but not too much. We're pretty close to where that's supposed to be. But the budget is supposed to be passed for the fiscal year before it begins in October. And what we've just seen is the budget that Congress just passed is for the fiscal year that we are now halfway through. Huh. So that is why they ended up coming so close together, where you had Congress passing a negotiated budget, and then right on its heels, you had the Biden administration requesting their budget for the next fiscal year. So both of those things kind of happened at the same time this year, but the Biden request is for next fiscal year, and the budget that just passed is for the fiscal year we're in right now. I will say there are a couple of things in the Biden budget, even though its general priorities are not what we would want to see. There are a couple of things that we should push for Congress to maintain. And those are a reduction in the number of detention beds for immigration. The Biden proposal reduces the number of detention beds from 34,000 to 25,000. So it's a significant reduction. And Congress is likely to undo that unless they feel appropriate pressure to maintain it. The other thing is that the Biden administration has proposed a one-third cut in the number of F-35 jet fighters that they're asking for, from the previous year and from many previous years. And that's significant because it's something that we've been pushing for a long time. And that is also something that Congress is likely to reverse unless they feel the pressure to follow what the Pentagon is asking for and to follow what's rational and to actually maintain those cuts.
Right. Often we see these budgets putting money toward the aspirations of lawmakers that are trying to prove to one another that they can outdo each other on security, defense issues, and being pro-military, even when it's not practical, even when the military itself says it doesn't necessarily need certain aspects. I want to go back to the New York Times article about the White House budget, about Biden's budget. The Times said the budget proposal put far less emphasis on the types of grand social, climate, and economic policies that Mr. Biden announced last year but have since run into resistance from moderate Democrats. I take issue with the term moderate Democrats. I feel like they really should be seen as conservative Democrats. But is this, does this justification fly to you?
Yes, yes. In fact, the fact that this budget looks so much like the requests that we've seen from past presidents is exactly because of that. It's because all of the priorities that were in Build Back Better have essentially been stripped away. There are some very small pieces in this budget proposal, but you don't see any of Biden's signature proposals for domestic spending, for childcare, for healthcare, for elder care, for climate. You don't see any significant signs of that in this budget. And I actually saw, I'm not remembering who to properly credit for this, but I actually saw someone call it the Manchin budget, because it does seem to be such a capitulation to, remember, there was one Democrat who stopped those priorities, and then with all of the Republicans. So it's certainly more of a capitulation to Republicans than to centrist Democrats, where there was only one who actually held us back.
What does the fact that Senator Bernie Sanders is, you know, heading the Senate Budget Committee, how do you think that'll play out in what comes next? He's a chair of the Senate Budget Committee. This was what progressives were happy about, you know, as a consolation prize to not winning the nomination of the presidency. At least he gets to have this very important position. So what do you think will happen?
So there are a couple of important things about that. One, of course, is just the megaphone that it gives him. And it certainly does make, you know, makes him more of a go-to person for media to ask about these things. And so that matters for public perception and for public understanding, because the way that Senator Sanders will talk about this is not the same as the way that previous budget chairs would have talked about it. So there's that. The other difference is that Senator Sanders is in the room. A lot of the negotiations for these budgets happen behind the scenes. And in the past, that has meant that whoever was in Democratic leadership would be in the room for those conversations, and anybody who wasn't in leadership would not. But now with Senator Sanders in this key position, he is much more in the room for those discussions. He's part of the negotiations, and the progressive viewpoint that he represents can't just be shunted aside. So it is meaningful, but clearly without the power of the right number of senators and members of the House of Representatives behind a budget that progressives would want to see, it's not enough to have one person in a key position.
What about Biden's claim that he is starting to undo the mess, I believe it was the word he used, left by Trump's tax cuts? And, you know, is there any reversal of it, given where we are with skyrocketing inequality and how, particularly during the pandemic, billionaires just minted money? It is, you know, if ever there was a time to slap huge taxes on the wealthiest Americans, and we're talking just a handful of people out of hundreds of millions, this would be the time. And does Biden, and these are very popular in the public, even among Republicans, does Biden's budget encompass enough of that?
So you mentioned the wealth growth of billionaires during this pandemic, and just for some context, the amount of wealth that billionaire wealth has grown in this country during the pandemic would be enough to cover the entire Biden budget discretionary proposal that we're talking about. It's just the growth in their wealth would be enough to cover the entire thing. So it's a huge amount of money. It's a huge resource. And it is very significant that that President Biden is proposing things like a billionaire wealth tax that would start to reverse some of that and start to reverse the Trump tax cuts from 2017 that were so damaging. So that is very meaningful, and it is a big win for movements who've been pushing for that for a long time. But on the other side, there's the spending side. And unfortunately, what the Biden budget is doing is it's moving back toward deficit reduction instead of toward putting more resources where we need them. There are multiple ways to find those resources. One, of course, is raising taxes on billionaires and corporations, which this budget is doing some of, and that's a very good thing. Another thing is to reallocate some of the funding that we have, which this budget is not doing, and which is what we need to see, is funding being drawn down for the military, drawn down for ICE and the Customs and Border Protection, that the agencies that were responsible for family separation and for detention of immigrants, we need to see those funds being reallocated to where we really need them. Because the truth is that they are not working to keep us safe where they are now. And we need to reallocate them into things like healthcare and job creation and education and all of the things that we all know we need.
So the next few weeks, Lindsay, I imagine are going to be critical in terms of seeing the debates shape up in Congress around budget priorities. This would be the time for those people who were heartened by Biden's progressive economic platform when he was a candidate to speak up and say, keep your promises, right?
Yes, yes. This is it, from starting right now until at least the fall, we need sustained pressure on members of Congress to push the budget in a more progressive direction. And like I said, to push it in a more progressive direction from where the Biden request is, but also to maintain those key things that are actually good in the Biden budget, right, that Congress would be very likely to reverse if we don't put enough pressure on them to maintain those better and decisions.
I'm wondering if you have any comments on the tactics here. When the president starts out with a budget that he thinks will please Joe Manchin, he's not using his bully pulpit, right? Instead, he could put forth a budget in line with his stated ideals and force Manchin to say no, no, no.
I think there have been definite mistakes in the approach to this. I think clearly some more public awareness of what this budget was or what the Build Back Better package was and what was in it before the negotiations got serious with Senator Manchin would have been much more helpful, so that it would be clear that the public was behind that package, which was the case, but it just, people didn't know enough about it. They weren't passionate enough about it to create the kind of pressure that would have been needed. So yes, it would have been a very good idea for the Biden administration to have gone out and sold this very hard to the public beforehand. And it's not too late for them to do that now. There's another shot at passing a lot of those priorities, even apart from this Biden budget request that came out this week. There's another chance to pass a lot of those priorities separately through the same reconciliation process that we heard about last year. And the key, of course, is to getting Senator Manchin on board. And that has to be a careful mix of negotiation with him, but also of clear public pressure that there will be consequences if he doesn't do what his constituents want.
Lindsay, thank you so much, as always, for joining us. What's a good website for people to find out about your work?
Our website is www.nationalpriorities.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Lindsay, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
My guest has been Lindsay Koshgarian, Program Director of the National Priorities Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on...
She's everywhere. It's only a weekly show now, though. I don't know. Being a young mother, maybe, has something to do with that. Here's Brian Edwards Tekert from Up Front, another view about the billionaire's tax right at the front here.
Wealth-based tax on households worth $100 million or more. We're going to discuss that at some point, but we're treating it as more of a messaging provision in the budget. Its fate is fairly uncertain in the Senate as currently composed. Another big piece of headline news is we have on our hands the largest military spending proposal in peacetime in the history of the United States. The $813 billion request from the Biden administration, which was crafted before the Russian invasion of Ukraine, is 4% higher than what Congress approved for the current year. Congress approved that just over a month ago. It almost certainly will go higher once Congress is done with it. That's typically what they do, is push the number up. And it is just a staggering sum of money after the United States, you know, wrapped up its longest running war in history by pulling out of Afghanistan. Joining us to go through the details and go over the implications, William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His books include Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
put the top lines in context. How big is this figure?
Well, it's staggering. I think one interesting thing about it is, they're trying to justify it on the basis of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But first of all, as you said, a lot of this was already in train before that happened. This notion that the war should spark the beginning of a new Cold War. This number is well over $100 billion more than what the United States spent at the height of the Cold War. So really, if you went to Cold War levels, you would reduce this budget, not increase it. So, it's also about 52% of all federal discretionary spending. So that's almost everything else the government does other than entitlement programs like Social Security and Medicare. So all the things that we need for the environment, for education, for job training, all of those have to fit within the budget and combined get less money than the Pentagon. So it's hard to imagine a larger figure, although, of course, Republicans in Congress are doing so, as you suggested.
So I want to get a little bit into the specifics before we go to the big picture. The close to $14 billion that Congress approved for Ukraine last month went into this year's military budget, right?
Well, they counted it somewhat separately because it was emergency. So there's actually going to be additional money in this budget beyond that $14 billion. And it's been hard to discern from the welter of documents released this week exactly how much this is going to be, and they didn't give a number in their briefings on it, but it'll be billions more.
I want to talk about some of the new hardware in here. $5 billion for a space-based missile warning system, another $2 billion for missile defense interceptors. What are they? What do they say about how U.S. appropriators are seeing the world?
Well, under Donald Trump, they created the Space Force, which was explicitly basically saying space is a theater of warfare. And they've tried to justify it based on Chinese and Russian activities in space. But most of the things we do on Earth are dependent on space. The commercial economy, also various military activities like targeting and so forth. So the last thing one would want to do is make space a theater of warfare, just because of the implications here. There should be some rules of the road for space, some sort of negotiation to keep weapons and things for targeting weapons out of space. And so far, there aren't, weapons that explode based in space, but some of these sensors would direct such weapons. Then in terms of missile defense, not only is that interceptor there, but for what they call missile defense and defeat, they've allocated $24 billion. And this is somewhat of a scam or a bait-and-switch operation, because there is no way to defend against missiles traveling at high speed, some of which will have decoys. There haven't been successful tests under realistic conditions. So this is just more money for the military-industrial complex, and it kind of is used as a backhanded justification for the nuclear weapons buildup, because the notion is so far the United States can use nuclear weapons, but they can defend against those as if there's a technical fix, when actually the only way to protect us is to reduce nuclear weapons and ultimately eliminate them.
$6.1 billion in here for Pacific deterrence. What is that?
Well, it'll be for weapons and additional military deployments in East Asia, targeted at China. And it's just an add-on. I mean, large parts of the budget are dedicated to naval and other deployments focused on East Asia. So in a way, it's an indicator of increased U.S. interest in militarizing the Asia theater, but it's just sort of a down payment on all the other things the Pentagon spends for that purpose, including a big buildup of the Navy, which is going to get about a $10 billion increase in procurement for new ships.
When you look at a budget request like this and try to work backward from what's being requested, how much do you chalk up to military planners being on a very aggressive footing? And how much do you chalk up to the influence of the weapons makers that get the contracts funded by these budgets?
Yeah, I think it's synergistic. For example, because they're so intertwined, you know, there's a revolving door between the Pentagon and other parts of the U.S. government and the industry. And the Government Accountability Project, rather the Government Accountability Office, a federal agency, found 1,700 examples just in the last few years of personnel going to industry to lobby for them, generals, admirals, people who know how the Pentagon buying system works. So you've got people making military decisions who are looking forward to cashing in on careers in industry, and that undoubtedly shapes their outlook. And then you have very specific cases like the National Defense Strategy Commission, which was a congressionally mandated body to analyze Trump's national defense strategy. It was more hawkish even than the Trump Pentagon and recommended a 3-5% annual increase in the Pentagon budget after inflation, which would push it to over $1 trillion in the next 5 or 6 years. That commission, more than half the members were from the boards of military corporations, consultants to the weapons industry, or from think tanks that got major funding from the weapons industry. So you've got the lobby, which not only helps shape the outlook and the strategy, but also, of course, places jobs in key districts, spends tens of millions on lobbying and campaign contributions to members that make these decisions. And that piece of it, that lobbying, leads to things like last year when Congress added $30 billion to the Pentagon's request. So they operate on a number of different levels. And I think, certainly hawkish outlooks and threat inflation are part of it. And then the military-industrial lobby is part of it. But they're kind of intertwined.
It is kind of wild to go through the coverage of this military budget and see requests for, you know, really big ticket items like new nuclear submarines. While there's news playing out about the invasion of Ukraine, where the U.S. is saying it has determined the most effective military aid it can deliver, are relatively inexpensive things like shoulder-fired missiles.
Yes, I think it's interesting. I mean, it's starting to add up. You know, the U.S. gave Ukraine $2.7 billion in arms aid from 2014 till last year. The Biden administration has added $2 billion of that over in a few months. Then there's another $3.5 billion that was in the emergency bill passed by Congress. And there's going to be still more in this budget. So it's probably $8 to $10 billion, a lot of it for, by Pentagon standards, not by, my standards, relatively inexpensive shoulder-fired missiles, anti-tank weapons. Some of the things are being transferred. They're taking Russian-style helicopters destined for Afghanistan, shifting them to likely be given to the Ukrainian armed forces. So on the one hand, that's a lot of money. On the other hand, it's only about 1% of what the Pentagon is asking for. So it's kind of like a double-edged thing. Certainly money pushed to Europe is being increased and arming Ukraine is being increased. But it doesn't justify, even if you accept all of that as necessary, it does very little to justify the huge increases in the Pentagon budget, but that's certainly how it's being used as a rationale.
As someone who is not a fan of the arms trade, what have been your thoughts watching the first month of fighting in Ukraine and the international community rallying to funnel more weapons into it?
Well, I understand the argument for defensive weapons to a country that's being invaded. On the other hand, it can easily get out of hand. And I think that's the point we're getting to, where there's talk of retransferring fighter planes. There was some talk of putting in missile defense systems that would require U.S. advisors on the ground in Ukraine. And there's more being asked for, both in terms of arms sales and things like a no-fly zone that could lead to direct combat between two nuclear-armed powers, the U.S. and Russia. So I think it has to be looked at. And, of course, if there were an armed resistance outside the traditional Ukrainian military, with small arms supplied by the U.S. and others. There's no telling where those would ultimately end up, as happened in Afghanistan, where many of them ended up in the hands of extremists who helped form Al-Qaeda. So there's many concerns about that. I'm not necessarily opposed to some forms of defensive weaponry, but as I said, it could easily get out of control.
We're speaking to William Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. His books include Prophets of War. What we're discussing is the budget request that came out of the Biden administration on Monday, including a record-breaking $813 billion in proposed peacetime military spending. That would be a record for peacetime, 4% more than the current year. By Bill Hartung's estimate, in constant inflation-adjusted dollars, $100 billion per year more than the U.S. spent at the height of the Cold War. The idea that we never really left a Cold War footing, the way these budgets are constructed, is the U.S. treating Russia like a global power adversary? Or has everything in Ukraine just been a distraction from the military's pivot to try to create a counterforce to China?
Well, in the briefings by the Pentagon yesterday, it was interesting because they led with Ukraine as the headline, but they quickly said China was the long-term challenge or threat, as they would put it. So in a sense, they're trying to have it both ways. You know, they want to bulk up in Europe, but I think the mass majority of funds will be focused on things rationalized by the need to compete militarily with China, which when you consider that the United States spends three times as much as China on its military, has 13 times as many nuclear weapons in its stockpile, has 750 global military bases, a dozen aircraft carrier task forces, which are deployed all over the world, China, you know, by that standard, is essentially a regional military power versus a global power by the United States. I think the real challenge or threat is scenarios that contemplate a war between the U.S. and China, because China also, of course, is nuclear armed, and it would cause probably unprecedented casualties. So the policy goal should be to prevent a war with China, not plan for it. And that doesn't seem to be where we are at the moment.
Preventing war, not the military's strong point. Bill Hartung, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
Brian Edwards Tiekert from the show Upfront. On Monday at 8 our time or so, 8:30 our time, he has a virologist, retired guy from Berkeley, on talking about COVID. So that's must listening for me. I suggest you try that out too. If you want to try and face the situation, well, I mentioned I was going to excerpt a little Chris Hedges from yesterday, and I've just got time to do that, so here it is. The part we're not hearing is the part where he's actually talking about how 6 years of his program On Contact were taken down by YouTube. He didn't think about suing, but Amy Goodman suggested it, so perhaps that will be discussed somewhere in a legal circumstance. Right now, he's just trying to keep his show going, which since RT America has folded. Sputnik is still there, I guess, and sometimes you have to go to Sputnik to hear Ray McGovern. It's pretty amazing for an ex-CIA guy, especially in Soviet policy in the day, goes there to get heard. All right, Radio Free Labor coming up. There's pretty full agenda. Bessemer, that's too close to call. Contested votes might actually swing it. It's not terribly hopeful, but it is a possibility, I understand. Here's Amy, or here's Chris Hedges, mid paragraph probably.
For the same reason, I denounced our invasion and occupation of Iraq at the inception, for which, of course, I ran into conflict and had to leave the New York Times, because preemptive war under post-Nuremberg laws is a criminal war of aggression. And I was very clear about that. Now, RT went dark 6 days later. I have a hard time believing Moscow would have allowed me to publicly embrace that kind of critique and remain on the air. I mean, I don't know. That's conjecture. But yes, I can't. It would be deeply hypocritical to lambast the United States for war crimes and not lambast Vladimir Putin for war crimes. With this caveat, the invasion of Iraq, occupation of Iraq, was based on lies and fabrications. I believe I was in Europe in 1989 covering the revolutions in Eastern Europe. This, of course, was we assumed naively that NATO would be obsolete. NATO was created to prevent Soviet expansion in Eastern, in Central Europe. I saw the leaders of Margaret Thatcher and the Reagan administration, Hans Dietrich Genscher, all promise Gorbachev that NATO would not be expanded beyond the borders of a unified Germany. Then later with the Clinton administration, after 13 or 14 states now, of course, are been integrated into NATO. Clinton administration promised not to station troops. This was another violation. Russia has every right to feel threatened and baited. That doesn't justify the war crime that they committed. I mean, they pulled the trigger. But again, this kind of understanding of the historical antecedents that led to the attack on the Ukraine. You've had Katrina on here. She, of course, knows Russia very well. That's almost unheard of within the kind of cheerleading for the media. Within the mainstream media.
Katrina VandenHeuvel, the publisher of The Nation. Chris, you wrote the award-winning book, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning. What does this war give Russia in terms of meaning?
Well, I just read the New York Times this morning, and they're talking about Putin's approval ratings going through the roof. That's what war does. It unleashes all sorts of dark, toxic poisons, including the poison of nationalism, which we imbibed in Iraq, and I think to a certain extent are imbibing now, ignoring the two decades of egregious war crimes that we committed in the Middle East. The idea that somehow NATO is a defensive organization would be greeted with ridicule in countries like Iraq or Afghanistan or Syria or anywhere else, or Libya or anywhere else. Of course, society is susceptible to that dark elixir. Russia is no exception. They've, of course, turned on their press, and they're drinking deep from it. But we're as guilty of that sin as the Russians.
What would you say to critics that say RT America, RT, was an outlet for Russian state propaganda, which is why it was targeted for removal by YouTube?
Well, to a certain extent, that's probably true. But are we better off not hearing what Russia has to say, not understanding why they think the way they do? I was a foreign correspondent for 20 years. My job was to be culturally, linguistically, historically, religiously literate, to step into the shoes of a Syrian or an Iraqi or a Palestinian. And of course, I spent 6 years in Latin America and then later in Yugoslavia and explain how the world looked from their vantage point, why they felt the way they did. And oftentimes, the grievances they have are very legitimate. I certainly think that Putin's complaints about the expansion of NATO have a great deal of credibility. It's just a historical fact that the leaders of the West lied to Gorbachev, lied to Yeltsin, and lied to Putin. That's just historically true. We're not a better world by shutting down these outlets and essentially living within our own echo chamber, especially when we wield the kind of military power that we do wield. And this gets into the whole collapse of foreign reporting. It's kind of gone the way of the dinosaurs, but it's extremely important, especially when you're an imperial power.
So speaking of the walls closing in and press freedom, I wanted to ask you about WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. This month, Britain's highest court rejected an appeal from Julian, who's seeking to block his extradition to the United States. The ruling means the British Home Secretary will have the final decision whether to turn Assange over to the Biden administration. He faces espionage charges that could bring up to 175 years in prison after he published classified U.S. documents on WikiLeaks that exposed war crimes, you know, the Afghan war logs, the Iraq war logs, State Department documents going back decades. Now, Julian Assange's lawyers argue he could face prolonged solitary confinement in a U.S. supermax prison, conditions that are tantamount to torture. Chris Hedges, you were in London last week as a guest of the imprisoned WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and Stella Morris for their wedding, which they fought for in the maximum security Belmarsh prison. And I just want to play what you said outside the prison.
A society that prohibits the capacity to speak in truth extinguishes the capacity to live in justice. And this is why we are here today. Yes, all of us who know and admire Julian decry his prolonged suffering and the suffering of his family.
So that's the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges speaking last week in London outside the Belmarsh prison. In January, we spoke to Stella Morris on Democracy Now! She was at that time the fiancé of Julian Assange.
Physical health and his mental health are obviously deteriorating because he's only a man. He's a fighter. He's a strong person, a strong-willed person who believes in the work that he's done, he's aware that this is a fight that against a monumental injustice. But there's only so much a man can take.
Stella, since we've spoken, you had applied to be married, the two of you. The prison forbade that and then reversed their decision. And today, as you stood outside the new court ruling, you said, "Today we won, but Julian continues to suffer. Julian must be freed." Your final 10-second comment.
Well, you know, Julian, for every win that we get, Julian's situation doesn't seem to change. And this is punishment through process, and it has to end. The Biden administration should just drop this. We shouldn't have to be taking it through the UK justice system, because this is a political prosecution that was initiated by the Trump administration, and it is causing ongoing harm.
So that's Stella Morris, now the wife of Julian Assange and the mother of their two children. Chris Hedges, if you can talk about what Julian Assange faces right now, does he have any final appeal, and why you believe he has been held for as long as he has before the Belmarsh prison, of course, taken refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy, where we interviewed him a number of times in London. He had been granted political asylum.
Well, there's been a long, let me just throw out that because UC Global, the Spanish security firm in the embassy, filmed all of Julian's meetings with his attorneys, revoking or destroying the capacity for attorney-client privilege, the case shouldn't even be in court. This has been a kind of judicial farce. Julian did not commit a crime. In fact, the people who did commit the crimes, which he exposed, have never been charged. He ripped back the veil in a way that no other publisher has done in our lifetime on the inner workings of power, whether it was the Podesta emails or Vault 7, which exposed the ability of the CIA to hack everything, our smartphones, our televisions, even our cars, or the Iraqi war logs, which you mentioned, and the ruling elites are determined to destroy him. So Stella mentioned his precarious condition. Well, it's quite dire. We know. I was in London covering the court trials, or they're not trials, actually, the hearings about the extradition. And he was observed pacing his cell frantically, banging his head against the wall, hitting himself in the face, hallucinating, calling the Samaritan hotline, because in his words, he thought about committing suicide hundreds of times a day. He suffered a stroke. He's on antidepressants. They haul him off to the medical wing in isolation. He's crumbling physically and psychologically, and I think that's the point. He can go back now. If as expected, the Home Secretary rules in favor of the extradition, he can go back to the lower court, which blocked his extradition based on his potential for being a suicide risk and the harsh conditions in American prisons. He can challenge the other points. This is a legal dance that I suppose could last up to a year. Meanwhile, he is, of course, deteriorating. But everything looks as if it is engineered to ship him off to Gordon Cromberg in the Eastern District Court of Virginia, who's the kind of grand inquisitor. He persecuted my friend Samuel Arian for years and sent Daniel Hale, who exposed the widespread killing of civilians by the drone program, into prison for 45 months. Those of us who have followed the case closely have just watched this burlesque of it's kind of, it's more like the Lou Bianco or a show trial than it is the best of British jurisprudence, which I think is one of the reasons they make it so difficult to cover. And I just want to throw in, Amy, that there were six guests, including Craig Murray, who's probably done the best coverage of the trial. And at the last minute, the prison denied us entry, along with a photographer, because it's part of making Julian disappear. There are no photos, no images of Julian other than that one in the police van. And after that, they put shutters on the windows so photographers couldn't take pictures of him. And that, I think, they didn't want us in there because, of course, we would write about it. I wrote about it anyway, because it renders him human and I think exposes the kind of suffering, inexcusable suffering that has been visited on him and his family and, of course, his two children and his father. So it's absolutely...
Chris Hedges on a roll there. That's from yesterday's Democracy Now. You should check it out. Please do. Please support community media, including this one, WEFT, Champaign, Urbana, listener-sponsored, volunteer-operated radio. Got a little underwriting announcement from people concerned about Campus Town and, let's see, what is it? Oh, downtown Champaign, where I am.
This hour of programming is supported by the listeners of WEFT and by the Champaign Center Partnership, who foster a vibrant, inviting, and active core downtown, midtown, and campus town by strengthening businesses and building community. CCP